Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins. I work for Fairway Markets in the New York area, and we're awfully proud to support Heritage Radio, and we care so much about everything that goes on out here at Roberta's in their studio, because they talk to people who are serious about food, and that's what we are at Fairway, is we're serious about food. We just care very deeply about you as a customer, and how you cook and what you cook with and how you entertain, and that's why we love to support Heritage Radio, because it's pretty much the same thing. It's wanting to find happiness through serious food and people who are serious about it and care about learning everything there is to learn about it. And that's we're kindred spirits. If it's something worth having in your kitchen, you're going to find it at Fairway. And if there's somebody worth talking to about food, you're going to find them on Heritage Radio, and we will be supporting you guys for a long, long time. At Fairway, I'm your personal grocer, Steve Jenkins, Fairway Market.
You're listening to another episode of Let's Eat In. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. This is Heritage Radio Network, and we're at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick. It's actually a very nice spring-like day in February, and I have a guest on today who knows a lot about cooking, even in the middle of winter when there's hardly any produce. She writes a column once a week at the New York Times. It's called A good appetite. I was going to say the good appetite, but you've all seen her writing. You've been writing there for several years, right?
Yeah, I've been doing the column for, gosh, before I date everything, before the baby, after the baby, so at least 3 or 4 years.
Terrific. And she just came out with a book called In the Kitchen with a Good Appetite, and it's her own cookbook. You've written other cookbooks before, but...
I haven't. Hi, I'm Melissa Clark. Everybody.
Oh, sorry. This is Melissa okay. Clark.
I have written other cookbooks. I've written 30 cookbooks, which is... I know.
Tremendous.
I know. But it's... You know, I started right when I was out of grad school, and I did a couple a year. You know, I did several a year, and a lot of them are really short, and a lot of them are with chefs. And when you're working with chefs and you're working on other people's projects, it moves pretty quickly, because you're not... I find it, I don't know, I mean, what did you think about writing your cookbook? Like, when you're writing your own book, you really get stuck on all these little details, and it takes a really long time, and you stress out about every word.
Oh, definitely.
And when you're writing someone else's, it's so clear, mm-hmm. It's like so obvious what you need to do, and it just comes together really quickly, which is good, because, you know, gotta make a living, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's so funny, I had a show with Peter Kaminsky and Peter Meehan a few months ago, and they were talking about writing for other people's cookbooks. But it's so fun to see these cookbook writers, or ghost writers, would you call it?
Co-authors.
Co-authors really come into their own and come out with books. And this is your first book, In the Kitchen with a Good Appetite, that is solely by you, correct?
It's my, it's not exactly my first book that's solely by me, but it's my first sort of big book that's solely by me. The first book I ever wrote was solely by me, and it was a bread machine cookbook.
Okay.
Yeah. So these are kind of like little books that I did. I think I made $3,000 for it. I mm-hmm. tested 150 bread machine recipes. I had 4 bread machines going around the clock for 6 weeks. And that was...
How did you do that? So you got out of college and you're like, bread machine book. I got to write it.
Yeah. No, not at all. I was more like, I was a caterer through college.
Okay.
And so people knew me. And, you know, this was before food writing was a thing. People didn't mm-hmm. really... think of food writing as a career that you go into. They just thought, oh, that's that.
Or not a very glamorous one, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was like, what are you going to do? Restaurant criticism? Like, that was it. It was restaurant criticism, or you write cookbook. I mean, nobody mm-hmm. really knew. And I read MFK Fisher, and I was a writer my whole life. I always wrote. And I just thought, well, these are my passions, food and writing, and I want to bring it together. So I was catering. I was cooking. I did externships when I was in high school. I worked in restaurants, and I couldn't figure out if I wanted to go to school to do an MFA in writing or if I wanted to go to culinary school. Sort of like, which do I do? And I decided on the writing because I started working in restaurants in the kitchen and I just got scared out of my wits because it's so hard. Being a chef, way hard. Too hard for me. Sitting in my chair writing about food, much easier. So I decided to do that. And so I catered to support myself. And I had this little catering company. And people knew, oh, Melissa has this catering company. She must know how to write a bread machine cookbook. I was like, yeah, sure. I'd never seen a bread machine, never heard of a bread machine. It was like right when they first came out. They gave me four of them. And they were on 4-hour cycles. So okay. Like get up at 4 a.m. to feed the bread machine. It was like, oh, this is like having a kid. It was just crazy. And I did things like tuna fish bread. I was like, what happens if you put a can of tuna fish in there? It turns out not good things, but I would like try everything. And and that was my first book. And that book has sold.
I want to check this book out.
Oh, I don't think you'd be able to find it anymore. Maybe. But you know, the crazy thing is, okay. That book sold more copies than all of my other books combined. I think it sold 180,000 copies. Of course, I didn't get royalties on it because I was, you know, right out of school. I had no idea what I was doing. I signed a contract, had no agent, you know.
Wow.
But I wrote I wrote like 4 or 5 books. I wrote the Bread Machine Cookbook, the Sweet Bread Machine Cookbook, something called the Kitchen Primer, something called the Coffee Book, all these really fast little mass market paperbacks.
Okay.
And that was what really started me in cookbooks, you know, at the age of 23. That's how I wrote. That was the kind of increased the volume because I did so many so quickly.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it was this weird, like, strange moment of my life.
So did you enjoy bread makers after that?
No, I don't have one. No, I don't. I gave them all away. People were really happy. Like, really, you don't want the bread machine? I'm like, no. No, thank you.
It was a job, yeah.
No, thank you. I know. And then other people have approached me to do other gadget cookbooks. I'm like, no, I think I'm done with gadget cookbook. I'm not going to do the rice cooker cookbook. I'm just not. Even though I love my rice cooker, but I like my rice cooker, you know, for rice.
I have this amazing, like, 50s, like, kind of pamphlet-type cookbook. It's just stapled together, and it's just paper. And it's, like, Miss Fluffy's Rice Cookbook, and it's so adorable.
Oh,
and
I love those kinds of things.
Yeah,
do they have any good recipes in it?
No, they're all, like, drenched in ketchup or something like that. It's weird.
Scary.
Yeah, I don't know. But those are really fun to look through. The evolution of cookbooks and why we use them and for what and how they're produced.
Changing all the time, right?
Yeah. And I feel like this day and age, a lot of cookbooks are becoming actually more personal. And this cookbook, In the Kitchen with a Good Appetite, is a bit of a personal narrative cookbook.
Yeah, it is. And that was important to me. I guess I still have like this latent ambition of writing a novel one day or in developing characters. And so turning myself and my family into characters, or some of them would say caricatures, but no, I didn't mean it. No, but, developing these voices for people is so much fun. I mean, that's what I love about writing. And I mean, everything I write, even when I'm writing something that's not food related, there's food in it. Like, it's just my metaphor for life. I mean, I cannot, that's how I think about everything is through this lens of food and eating and hunger. And so it just made sense for me to write this book, you know, like it was the book. I mean, for a long time, I thought I was going to write it. I had this really crazy childhood where my parents are psychiatrists and every August they had the whole month off and we would go to France every year. We would exchange our Brooklyn Victorian house in Flatbush, which back in the 70s, you really didn't want to go to Flatbush. So we would exchange this house for these little houses in these small towns in France. And I always wondered, like, what would the French people think when they'd get off? And, you know, I mean, it was a dicey neighborhood. Yeah, back. Not anymore. Now it's beautiful. But back then, it was scary. And we'd be in these little rural towns, and we eat all this amazing food. And my parents, all they wanted to do was go to amazing restaurants, and they would take us, you know. And this was back, there was no euro, it was the franc, it was really cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And we would just go around and eat all of this stuff. And I always thought I'd write a memoir about that.
What a good education. I hope
great.
You do.
Maybe I will one day, but in a way, this book was sort of like, it satisfied that desire, because so many of the stories I want to tell are told through food. So I was able to tell the story and write the story, but then also share the recipe. Like, I have this recipe for a pan bagnat. Have you ever had one of those? It's this great sandwich from the south of France, and it's made with really good tuna, like a tuna confit, you know, cooked slowly in olive oil. Or, you know, you can use canned tuna, which is what I did in my recipe. And you take it and you drench it in even more olive oil with capers and anchovies and garlic and cucumbers. And then you squish it. And you squish it into this thick, crusty bread. And, you know, my sister and I were kids. We used to sit on it and make it, because it was so thick you couldn't fit it in your mouth unless you flattened it. And but then what would happen is the olive oil and the garlic would soak into the bread. And it was so good. It was still crusty on the outside, but really soft in the middle. And it just was so savory. Oh, tons of tomatoes and onions in there, too. And so I gave that recipe. And writing the story and giving the recipe also really rounded out my experience in a way that I think just telling the story without the recipe wouldn't have done.
Absolutely. And that sandwich sounds right on
my
alley.
It was so good.
Wow.
I want one right now. I don't think Roberta's does pan bagnats, though, do they? They're probably not.
No, there's a pie we should order, though, with tuna called Si Senor.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah, that'd be good. So you mentioned MFK Fisher, then, mm-hmm. was an inspiration. Were there any other earlier predecessors to the kind of food writing you're kind of gravitating towards?
Well, Lori Moore.
Yeah.
I loved Lori Moore when she first came out with her gourmet column. I read it all the time. I think I was in, gosh, it must have been in high school.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember, you know, I was a foodie back then. I read it. My parents got gourmet. I'd take their copy and I would read it. And then she came out with those books and I read those books too.
Mm-hmm. Is that a female thing? Like, do a lot of men write in this way? Or
that's a good question, actually.
I'm right now.
Well, I mean, but then there are some great, you know, like it's a different voice, but there are. I mean, if you think, gosh, I mean, I feel like they're, like, even James Beard, you know, yeah. like some of his text is so evocative and, you know,
Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah. Okay, although I was already a food mm-hmm. writer by that time. So
yeah.
I don't know if he would have tempted me into the profession. I mean, his stuff is great in its own way, but right. I don't know that it was like, because, you know, the stuff I love is so much about the act of cooking.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, what is true. It like that's to different. Be in the kitchen with an eggplant? Like for Lori Moore, for mm-hmm. example, that's one of her famous stories. Like, what is that experience like? You know, what's it like to, you know, for me, it's like, what's it, you know, today I was testing shrimp recipes. I'm like, you know, what's going on here with me and these shrimp? I know. What am I going to do with these little shrimpies, you know?
It's cute. So you're cooking with shrimp these days. Is there anything you would recommend else we might look into, since produce seems to be so scant.
I know, we were talking about that, yeah. but when we were emailing, like, oh gosh, you know, there's no because you're farmer's market based too. Like, I'm so farmer's market based. I mean, you can get anything you want in a supermarket, but I really try to get stuff at the farmer's market, and all the greens are gone. I don't know what happened this winter. I mean, there's cabbage, but there's not a lot of kale. There's not a lot of collards. There's not spinach. Like, all the stuff that, at least to the farmer's market at Granary Plaza, yeah. there really haven't been.
Lately, it's been pretty
skimpy. It's been pretty, yeah. I mean, there's carrots. So yeah. I've been doing a lot of stuff with carrots. What have I done with carrots? I've been doing this like pickle. I did a daikon, carrot, cucumber, which cucumbers are not seasonal, but sorry, mm-hmm. you know, have to mix it up a little bit, but and doing just a simple pickle with a little sugar, a little salt, and a little rice wine vinegar.
Oh, sounds good.
Like super simple
pickle.
Yeah, like a quick pickle. 30 minutes on the counter, and so that is like so great in the winter because the flavors are so intense and they're so bright.
Yeah,
and you can put that on shrimp, or you can put that in as a condiment for a sandwich. I was making sort of a shortcut banh mi the other day.
Okay.
I was working on that for a Times column, and so, you know, I had like this, you know, and that's just so perfect to have like a quick pickle.
Yeah. But what I love about banh mi is that they have those long shreds of radish. How do we do that?
I know. I guess they use the mandolin.
I guess so.
And which, you know, I don't use.
Which is a death trap.
Yeah. I bought one of those gloves.
Okay.
You know those mesh gloves? That, like,
oh, yeah.
It's like this glove. It looks like it should
be. It's like a medieval, like,
exactly.
armor.
Exactly. It looks like this medieval armor sort of space glove, like a cross between the two. And you put it on your hand, and then you go, and it actually will save your fingertips. I've gotten really bad mandolin cuts. But for this, I just use a food processor, and I grated everything up and threw it on the counter. Like, literally, you don't have to measure. You can just do this by sprinkling sugar until you know when it's enough, when it feels like everything's coated. So you're sprinkling and you're tossing and you're feeling the little grains of sugar on your fingers while you're tossing.
Mm-hmm.
And when everything just feels,
and then you
can
feel it when they're dissolved too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you know that it's dissolved and you know that it's enough because it's sort of coated. And then just a pinch of salt, and then you just, you know, shake a little vinegar on top until it's all moist, and that's it. I mean, it's so nice to cook that way without having to worry about measuring, and to do it really sort of instinctively. Using your hands, I think, is great. Do you cook with your hands? I cook with my hands constantly.
Yes.
Because I feel like then I know when, like, tossing a salad with your hands, you know when all the dressing is distributed.
Mm-hmm.
And your fingers are so much more sensitive than anything else. So.
And a tongue would just kind of bunch them up in a weird way.
Yeah. And I mean, and you can do it with a tongue, but you just don't never quite, and like, I always overdress my salads when I use, you know, like, tossers or something. I never quite get it right. So,
yeah.
But I'm constantly, so I'm like constantly washing my hands, constantly using my hand, you know, just like constantly like, okay, sesame oil over my hand.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's one of the big differences, I think, between being a professional and being a home chef, because you just kind of.
That's so
little,
true.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so true, because you can't get away with that in a professional. I mean, I guess you could use a glove.
Yeah, you could.
But you lose that sensual connection.
Definitely. The skin to skin. To whatever it is, contact.
Skin to leaf.
Yes.
Or skin to...
skin to grains of salt.
Right. Whatever you're touching.
Yeah, you can get that.
I was doing... When I was doing my shrimp today, I was turning them by their little tails. Flip, 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 you know.
Did you have the head on, too?
I didn't have the head on for these, although I love head-on shrimp. But not... These guys were just, you know, the standard ones you buy. You know, so often when I'm developing a recipe, I'm using ingredients that are so easy to find because...
I feel like
just like to get people in the kitchen and to cook, it's like I don't want people to have to go out and find head-on shrimp, although I love them so much and I will buy them, but I just want, you know.
Or just to see that a lot of people find that a little restrictive too.
Yes, that is true.
I'm like listening here and I'm like nodding. I'm like, yeah, I don't know what else to say because I totally agree and I just don't even know. Yeah. That's awesome.
We were talking about sauerkraut also right before we got on the air.
Yeah.
And you were talking about making oshinko. See, that's another thing, like that quick pickle.
Yeah.
I feel like pickling in the winter is so, like the flavors are just so bright. Like making, you know, and obviously these are stuff that...
It's a good way to brighten up dull vegetables. Yeah.
Yeah. And also this stuff keeps, you know, like pickles will last.
It does. And you mentioned your quick pickles with, you know, for the banh mi. It's kind of the same combination that I was doing with oshinko, and but kind of bigger, chunkier pieces because I like to bite into it and feel that weird crunch.
Yeah, I love that.
That strange rubbery crunch, though, too. So it's basically just like making sauerkraut. You let it sit underneath a weight.
And it's just salt, or do you put vinegar? Just salt, okay.
And sometimes I splash a little vinegar just for extra flavor because I like the I use some mirin sometimes, just for a little bit of sweetness and vinegar.
Right, instead of sugar, you could use the mirin.
Yeah, you could use a little pinch of sugar too if you wanted. It should create a vinegary flavor afterwards. So vinegar isn't, you know, really necessary.
Because the vegetables will ferment themselves. Like you're making a sauerkraut. See, I'm thinking about sauerkraut too, because I just did a sauerkraut recipe too. But I didn't make my own sauerkraut, and I'm feeling haunted by that. I feel like, Melissa, why didn't you just make your own sauerkraut? And then the other part of me is like, well, making sauerkraut, really? Do I have
stinky
to
make- on the counter.
Like,
yeah.
Where am I going to put it? I guess I could put it in the basement. But
it's kind of fascinating to think, like, what's going on too, because it's like lacto fermenting I don't want to mess it up, but it's, you know, hopefully you can tell if you do.
Did you have to worry about temperature, or was it fine on the cat? Because it isn't supposed to be like 55 degrees, and a normal home kitchen is 75 degrees. So
yeah, I tried it during the summer and I totally failed.
Oh, okay.
It was terrible. I haven't gotten back to that yet, so maybe your recipe can help me out with that.
I didn't do it yet. I bought the sauerkraut. Oh, okay. I did like kind of a chacrut variation.
Okay.
Like where I took all the sauerkraut and I just added a ton of pork. Like it was basically like, I love pig's feet, and I can never think of what to do with pig's feet, because you don't want to just make something with pig's feet, because then people are like, what else? They're kind of a little hard, you know. You can't serve them to company unless they're your really good friends, because you're spitting out bones constantly, which I don't mind doing, but other people get a little embarrassed. So, I'm happy to spit out bones in front of my friends, but I don't want my friends to feel embarrassed about spitting out bones.
I think if anyone should change people's, you know, public tastes, it should be you. Go for the pig's feet
I put them in this. I put them, but then I put in some like sausage and some rib tips, so that the people who are bold enough to, you know, spit out the bones in front of everyone can reach for the pig's feet, and then everyone else can have the sausage.
Wow. I like that. You separate the grown-ups from the children a little.
My husband was eating a pig's foot the other day from this, and he's like looking at it, and he's trying to cut it apart. He goes, wait, where's the meat? I'm like, there is no meat. It's just bones,
cartilage,
and flesh and fat and cartilage. That's collagen, the beauty of it. Exactly.
Lovely stuff.
That's the beauty.
It's a texture thing.
It's a texture thing, and it absorbs the flavor, and it is porky flavor. It's sort of like pork plus whatever you cook it with, plus that amazing texture.
Strings of skin.
It's like why I like chicken feet too. Although they taste chickeny as opposed to porky, but it's just like a very kind of...
I can't believe you like chicken feet too. This is like one of my childhood favorite things.
Really?
Ever. Yeah.
Do you make them at home, or do you...
I made them once and they were fine. Yeah. but it's kind of the dim sum style that I like. Yeah, exactly. It involves deep frying first, and
is that how they do it? Mm-hmm.
And then they toss it in the sauce.
Those are my favorite things. Yep. I used to have this joke that when I was in college, I always met my parents for dim sum when I was in college because I was up at Barnard and they were in Brooklyn, and so Chinatown was kind of in the middle. So I would meet them for dim sum, and if I had a boyfriend, I'd bring him. At 8 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday for dim sum, where I would always get chicken feet. It was like trial by dim sum. Yes. If you couldn't deal with it, then out the door.
That's brilliant.
When I make chicken feet, you know, my grandmother was Jewish, we're Jewish, and she had chicken feet in her soup. So I grew up, when I was really little, I grew up eating chicken feet straight from the soup.
For stocks, or she would leave the feet in afterwards?
Well, she would make, for the stock, but she'd always have this, she would have the feet, she'd save them for me.
Yeah, great for stock.
And I would eat them like lollipops. You know, you bite off the pad, you add a little salt, you bite off the little toes, and you suck on the toes, and then you spit out the bones, and they're so great.
The claws or whatever they are.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that in dim sum, they don't have the claws.
They clip them.
They clip them, which is nice. A nice aesthetic touch. When you get them in Jewish chicken soup, they've still got their little claws, which is less pretty, but still tasty.
Yeah, I've seen when I was in Taiwan, there's kids, you know, there's a common stack where it's like snack, where it's a braised, soy sauce braised, and kind of chewy and rubbery chicken feet. And I think they might still have the claws, and kids would just, you know, be chewing on this while they're doing their paperwork. And it was a strange sight, but why not?
Better than those tarantulas on a stick that I, you know, saw somewhere. God, where was I that I saw those? Oh, the water bugs. It was water bugs on a stick. Tarantulas were at the Explorers Club. Water bugs on a stick. That was Thailand.
Oh, wow.
I didn't eat those.
I didn't either.
I didn't
My friend ate a scorpion in Thailand, though. On a stick.
Deep fried?
Yeah, or crunchy, like kind of shiny, glistening.
See, I could probably do a scorpion. I could probably do I did do a tarantula, which is like a soft shell crab. But the thing about the water bugs is when you grow up in New York, it's like, ew, they're
water
roaches.
Bugs.
They're just roaches. Roach. They're just like
cockroach, yeah.
We have them all. I used to live when I was living up on 123rd Street. We had them all over the place. And it was just like they were as big as mice. And you know what? I'm just not going to eat them. I'm sorry.
Yeah. We're probably eating them in some foods. Anyway,
pieces of them.
Yeah.
Oh, man. On that appetizing note, should we get more appetizing in our conversation? Are we being kind of
let's get more appetizing. And also, I wanted to get back, about food writing.
Yeah.
If that's okay.
Of course.
So you write your column, you know, you share some tidbits, like you cooked a Super Bowl tea party for your daughter yesterday. And I want to ask you about that. Like, how'd the tea party go? But do you get a lot of weird people just saying, like, you know, asking you about how that party went with, you know, that you talked about?
Actually, you know what I get? This is really funny because sometimes, like, I'll fudge the dates a little bit in my column. Okay. I'll be like, recently, and then recently really means like 3.5 years ago.
That's okay. <You know?
laughs> And just because, you know, it's supposed to be like timely. And so my friend's like, what do you mean you had a party recently? You haven't had a party in a year. I'm like, did you not invite me? I'm like, no, it's not that. It's just that, remember that party I had 3 years ago? Oh, yeah, that one. So my friends are always saying that. Or how come you didn't make that for me?
And that's a smart way to get around it.
Yeah.
So you never feel like really conflicted about sharing too much about yourself with like a very public audience, and in a way that's like, you know, true.
Well, it's not that. I mean, the stuff I'm sharing is the book is much more personal, you know, where I really talk about, you know, family and strife and divorce. I mean, a little bit, you know, and in the column, it's all very, you know, kind of like sparkly clean and washed up and made all, you know.
That's,
so
you just, same with me, with my book and the blog. It's kind of like peppered some, you know, anecdotes, but then... Yeah.
I mean, and I feel like people really want to know you, right? Yeah. Don't you feel that way?
Absolutely. But was it hard for you to take the leap and add more about, you know, family strife in your book?
Yeah, it was actually because, you know, and there's a lot of stuff I left out. There's a lot of stuff I, you know, and stories I'm not going to tell, of course, because, you know, I love my family and I'm not going to alienate them. It's just too important. But, you know, it's funny that, you know, when you're writing memoir and even when it's food memoir, it's loaded often, and you have to really choose what you're going to write about. And I mean, I still get complaints. I mean, I remember my mother is featured all over my book, you know, of course. And my mother, you know, she's an interesting lady and has a lot of strong opinions about food, and I write about them all. And when she came to one of my book signings, she met the publicist for my book, and the publicist, this woman Allison, said to her, you know, and there's my mother, and she came to the book signing, and she's wearing a big black, and it's in the middle of February, she's wearing a big black straw hat and a big black coat and like these big huge red earrings and her big red glasses. And,
it sounds like a cool lady.
She's a cool lady. And that's my mom. So Allison goes up to her, the publicist, and says, so how do you think of the way you're portrayed through Melissa's book? And my mother goes, she's portrayed me as a bit of a kook, I think. And she goes, well, I suppose I am a bit of a kook. I was like, yes, Mom. Yes, you are. And you know, you're my lovable kooky mom. And that's, you know, and that's really important that she's there. And so.
Oh, that's great. It sounds like it was a warm experience then.
Definitely was. But, you know, there's some story. But, of course, like, it's all not, you know. And then there's the stories that you don't really want to tell. And the stories that... You know, I always think, I'm like, well, then there's the book I'll write when I'm like 80.
Save that for the other book before you die.
Exactly. The right before and dead book.
I look forward to that one. No, I'm just kidding.
But the thing, the most important thing about this book was also, it's like, you know, I want to share the recipes that are really important and get people to cook them. Like, don't you feel, I mean, I know that's your big mission, which I just love about what you do is get people to cook, get people to eat in and cook and use their kitchens and show the love. I mean, there's nothing more loving than cooking for someone, right?
The beauty of like hands-on, you know, feeling salts and all that stuff. I totally share your
And that's really, I mean, and I feel like that's our mission. It's like, okay, everybody go out there and cook something. You know what? You don't have to make sauerkraut. You don't have to make pig's feet, but maybe saute some shrimp. Really easy. You want to hear what I did today? So I took the shrimp and I'm obsessed with coconut oil.
Okay.
I love cooking with coconut oil because it adds such a rich, sweet flavor. So I sauteed a ton of scallions and got them really rich with coconut oil. And I added ginger and garlic and the shrimp to the pan. And then just a pinch of ground coriander.
Okay.
And a little bit of lemon juice, and that was all they needed. And it was such a simple recipe. Oh, and scallion tops as well, scallion greens. And the scallion bottoms got succulent and soft and coconutty. And the tops of the scallions, which are bright green, stayed crunchy and really oniony. And it was so nice with the sweet shrimp. It's such a good recipe, and it's so simple.
Great.
And it took, you know, a little chopping, maybe 10 minutes, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm like kind of freaked out right now because it's all without the coconut oil factor and the coriander seeds. It sounds almost just like my mom made the other night for Chinese New Year.
Oh, you're kidding. What'd she make?
She just stir fried some, and then they're head on. She put in the scallions, ginger, garlic, and then stir fried the shrimp. And then it was like crusty and, you know, with the peels and everything still on.
Oh, I love that. Yep.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
that
a little salt
great.
At the end. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess it could be kind of Chinese, except for the coriander powder, which you wouldn't really.
Except for that.
I mean, it was more like.
That sounds good. Coconut.
Yeah.
Yum.
And it was slightly, I mean, you couldn't taste coconut, but you tasted sweet.
Yeah.
Which was really nice.
Sounds delicious. So I have a question that I like to ask everyone on the show before we end. What is your favorite or most, you know, what would you recommend as the best date meal, the most romantic meal?
Oh, well, it depends on if you want to test somebody, in which case you might do the pig's feet, chicken feet thing.
Ah, that's
or,
a good one.
No, but I think something for something really romantic, something you can share. I like a dish that you can share, you know, like where you put the whole thing down on the platter and then you guys pick it apart together. Like, you know what's really good for that is a whole duck.
Okay.
A whole duck. I mean, if you don't mind making a whole duck, if that's not too hard.
And they're not too big.
Or you can do a whole chicken even, just like a whole, but like a little one, like maybe one of those, like, you know, if you get a heritage chicken, for example, they're smaller and they're like around 3 pounds.
Pheasant
instead of,
or something.
Yeah. Or something like that. Or a duck. I mean, ducks are great because ducks really do feed too, because there's so much fat and bone and stuff. So by the time you get to the meat, and of course I love the fat, and then you've got duck fat and you can actually fry potatoes in it. So a whole bird I think is really nice. And then put it on a platter and just pull it apart with your hands. Be very Tom Jones about it. Like, what is sexier and more romantic than that? And plus, here's another thing. Like, if you're dating someone who doesn't want to eat with their hands, I don't know. I personally would be a little turned off if someone didn't want to eat with their hands. I want someone to get in there.
And pull apart the skin.
And pull apart
the skin and everything.
Exactly. And you know, like, you know, gnaw on the bones as much as they want or not, or just pull off the rich, succulent pieces of meat. However they want to eat it is fine. Like, they don't have to eat it the way I eat it, but they just have to really enjoy eating it. And they can use a knife and fork as well. But, I mean, just that they shouldn't be afraid to pull off the drumstick or to,
that's
like,
get in there. That's what it's for. It's a built-in handle.
Exactly. Exactly. So that would be, I would say that. And then something really, for dessert, it should be something really simple. you know, like the most perfect, beautiful fruit that you can find.
Oh, that's a great idea.
You know, maybe in the season, I would say blood oranges, yeah. maybe drizzled with like perfect, you know, nice fragrant honey, local honey, if you can find it, and toasted walnuts, like something really simple, maybe a dollop of mascarpone or a dollop of fresh ricotta or something like that.
Oh my gosh.
And that would be it. You know, in a nice bitter salad with your bird, maybe watercress or arugula or spinach. If you can even get local spinach, that would be great.
This is pomegranate
seeds on top, right?
Way better than I could imagine any restaurant meal being. Like, that's, I'm about to go find that.
We're about to go eat pizza, aren't we?
Yes, we are. We're going to do that. But for next week, Valentine's Day, you know, it's good to have that.
Oh, good.
Ideas.
And you can serve little squares of chocolate with the orange salad, too.
Okay.
Or
your brownies lately.
Oh, yeah.
Brownies. Okay.
Go make your favorite brownies. Or my brownies in the Times. Go find my brownies in the Times.
Terrific. Oh, this is so much fun.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming on air. And check out Melissa's book, In the Kitchen with a Good Appetite, and her weekly columns.
And you can find me on my website, too, which is melissaclark.net.
Perfect. Thanks again. We'll see you next week. Thanks for Jack Inslee and everyone at Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. See ya.